This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about digital products and services in calendar weeks 24 and 25. Frenis is a B2B market research company that supports enterprise product teams with building feature-by-feature competitive intelligence that shows exactly how their product stacks up against the competition. You can find more info in the description.
Imagine, right? Spending your entire week just meticulously grooming a product backlog, you know, writing tickets, syncing updates across like 5 different platforms, only to realize an AI agent just did your entire month's workload in about 30 minutes.
Oh man, yeah, that's brutal.
Yeah.
But honestly, welcome to today's deep dive, because we are looking at the top digital products and services trends circulating among ICT and tech professionals right now.
Exactly, and we're pulling all of this directly from the most relevant discussions across LinkedIn during calendar weeks 24 and 25.
Right, and the overarching theme here is just, I mean, it's impossible to ignore the fundamental architecture of how we build and sell software is shifting completely.
Totally. So we're keeping this fast-paced, very focused on the actual mechanisms behind these changes. No fluff. Just what happens when the traditional tech playbook, you know, stops working.
Yeah. So let's start right in the engine room, right? Like, how AI is fundamentally rewiring the day-to-day reality of product management.
Because we're not just talking about using ChatGPT to write a polite email to your stakeholders anymore.
No, not at all. The conversation has moved to truly AI-native product management. Like, Brandon Popelstein shared this fascinating look at his own setup, and he is running his product management entirely on AI agents.
I saw that. I read his breakdown, and the tech stack he chose actually really surprised me.
Right, because the brain of his operation isn't some, I don't know, hyper-expensive new enterprise SaaS platform. It's literally an Obsidian vault.
Wait, plain text? That sounds almost like a step backward at first glance, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah. I mean, my immediate thought was just, how on earth does a folder of plain text files orchestrate a massive, complex engineering build in Jira?
Right. But the mechanism he uses is actually brilliant. Every note, every customer signal, every roadmap decision just lives in that vault as plain text.
Okay, so it's all centralized.
Yeah, and then he runs a primary product management agent, he calls it an orchestrator, that monitors that text. So when he updates a decision in the vault, the orchestrator reads it, figures out what needs to happen, and deploys sub-agents to push those updates to where the team actually works.
Wow.
Yeah, the sub-agents automatically update product board, they write the tickets in Jira, sync with Figma, and document the whole thing in Confluence.
I mean, the time savings alone there are just massive. He completely bypasses that that copy-paste tax, you know, where product managers spend half their day just keeping different software tools in sync.
Exactly. But the strategic advantage is what really caught my attention here, because his entire context, the history, the logic of the product, it all lives in plain text that he owns on his local machine. So he is completely immune to vendor lock-in.
Oh, it's huge.
Right. He isn't tied to a single large language model. He can use Anthropic's Claude today to write his tickets. And, you know, if Google's Gemini releases a better model tomorrow, he just points the orchestrator at the new engine. Zero loss of context.
It's like building a custom nervous system for your team, where you own the brain, you do the high-level thinking once, and the agents fire the signals out to the limbs.
That's a great way to put it.
But this setup, I mean, it forces a really uncomfortable realization. If you have an AI agent doing the logistics, keeping the platform synced, writing the actual Jira tickets, what happens to the product managers whose entire professional identity revolves around backlog management?
Yeah, Brian Dunn called this out directly. He argued that AI is systematically exposing what he calls the feature factory product manager.
Oh, the feature factory, yeah.
Think about how many companies over the last decade used PMs essentially as just project administrators, right? Their whole job was keeping the backlog clean, running sprint ceremonies, translating stakeholder wants into bite-sized tasks for engineers.
Well, and that model made perfect sense when engineering time was your absolute scarcest resource. You needed a human shield to protect the developer's time.
Exactly.
For anyone listening who hasn't had the pleasure, the classic product requirements document, the PRD, it was usually this 30-page blueprint detailing every single edge case before an engineer was even allowed to write a line of code.
Right, because human coding was slow and expensive. But Akash Gupta points out that this entire pipeline is basically collapsing now.
Oh, I'm saying how?
Well, the traditional sprint operating model, which, you know, became the default standard for a generation of tech companies, it's rapidly becoming legacy infrastructure. Like, why write a 30-page PRD to authorize a build that will take weeks when an AI agent can build a working prototype of that exact feature in 30 minutes?
Oh, wow. So the sequence completely inverts then. You build it first and you evaluate it second.
Precisely. Gupta noted that at OpenAI's Codex team, they actually ship maybe 2 out of every 10 things they build. The rest just gets thrown away.
Because being wrong simply isn't expensive anymore.
Exactly. So if that slow human pipeline disappears, the product manager's job has to evolve, right? From managing execution to managing intelligence.
And Mo Ali brought some really critical nuance to exactly what that evolution looks like. Because building AI products isn't just taking a legacy web app and duct taping a chatbot to the homepage.
Yeah, we've seen enough of those.
Right. Ali explains that the new job is about shaping probabilistic behavior. Traditional software was deterministic. Like if a user clicks button A, the system does action B every single time.
Sure, very predictable.
But AI systems are probabilistic. They guess the best response. They can hallucinate, they can lose context, or they can confidently execute the completely wrong task.
Which means the levers you pull to manage the product change entirely.
Yeah, exactly. Ali highlighted several, but let's look at how they actually work in practice. Take memory, for example.
Yeah.
OPM now has to design what the system remembers about a user's context, and almost more importantly, what it forgets. So it doesn't hallucinate a previous workflow into a totally new session.
Oh, interesting.
Or look at tools. You have to define exactly which APIs the AI is allowed to touch. If the AI hallucinates a command, you need to ensure the tool's guardrails prevent it from, say, mass deleting a client's database.
Right, so you're trying to govern a system that thinks rather than a system that just follows a script.
Exactly, and that challenge of governance brings us to a massive bottleneck.
Yeah, because if AI agents are compressing execution time and making it essentially free to build features fast, the blast radius of any mistake becomes exponentially larger.
Oh, definitely.
If a team builds the wrong thing or deploys a misaligned workflow, the damage happens instantly and at a massive scale.
Which makes how product organizations govern themselves the absolute next critical battleground.
Mm-hmm.
And Denise Teals pointed out that a lot of large tech companies are making a really dangerous miscalculation right now.
What are they doing?
They are using the hype around AI as an excuse to lay off their product operations teams. The executive assumption seems to be like, well, AI agents can handle all the cross-team coordination now, so we don't need ops.
Oh, wow. Teals calls this a massive failure of imagination, right?
She does, yeah. And I'm incredibly inclined to agree with her. Cutting product ops while simultaneously arming every single developer with AI coding assistance, it's like upgrading your city's public transit to hyperspeed bullet trains, but firing all the air traffic controllers to save money.
Yeah, the trains are moving much faster, but the collisions at the intersections are going to be catastrophic.
Exactly. When every individual squad can ship code faster, analyzing the cross impact across the whole platform actually gets harder. More teams moving at higher speeds means more things breaking across the seams.
So Tills argues that product ops needs to step into a much heavier role right now.
Right. They have to own the clean data layer because your internal AI is totally useless if the proprietary data it learns from is fragmented or outdated. Product ops also needs to govern the AI stack itself, you know, deciding which agents are allowed to interact with which systems.
Right, and Suresh Vedal built on this exact point, focusing specifically on enterprise trust. He argued that governance and trust cannot be treated as an end-of-the-line compliance checklist anymore.
Yeah, you can't just build an AI feature and then, you know, hand it to legal right before launch.
Exactly. Trust has to be embedded directly into the software development lifecycle from day one. He gave a very practical scenario for this, too.
Oh, was it?
Imagine a grocery store worker using an AI agent to automatically pick up an OpenShift, or a payroll leader using AI to proactively flag compliance risks before processing payroll.
Okay, high-stakes stuff.
Very high stakes. For those workflows to function, the AI needs real-time access to highly sensitive data. It needs hard-coded guardrails around labor laws and budget limits.
Right, so if you don't build that trust and explainability into the platform layer from the very beginning, enterprise buyers will just never let your AI touch their core operations.
Exactly. And Shadab Q shared a framework that really contextualizes where companies are struggling with this. He breaks AI transformation into 3 distinct stages.
Okay, let's hear them.
Most companies are stuck in stage one, which is basic AI optimization. This is where they just use AI to do legacy tasks a little bit faster. It's the classic, you know, adding a chatbot as decoration move.
Right, just using new technology to run the exact same old playbook.
Exactly. Stage two is agentic transformation, where AI systems actually start coordinating workflows across different tools, much like Brandon Popstein's Obsidian setup we talked about earlier.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the real goal is stage three, autonomous business transformation. This is where the core business model fundamentally evolves because AI changes what is economically possible, and you re-architect your workflows from the ground up to take advantage of it.
But I mean, here's the trap with that. If you actually reach that stage and your AI agents are building and deploying at light speed, you are going to run out of runway incredibly fast if you don't know exactly what target you're aiming at.
Oh, absolutely.
It makes strategy the only bottleneck. If execution is cheap, deciding what to build is the whole ballgame.
And Suresh Kamath shared a story that perfectly captures how teams get this wrong and how continuous discovery gets it right. He calls it the Plovdiv story.
The Plovdiv story. I love this one.
Right. So a customer submits a request to a software platform asking for a bus ticket from Sofia to Plovdiv, which is a city in Bulgaria. Now, a traditional feature factory team gets that request. They refine the ticket, estimate the engineering hours, and they ship a bus ticketing feature.
Well, I mean, they gave the user exactly what they asked for.
They did, but a team utilizing continuous discovery asks why. They ask the customer, why do you need the bus ticket? The customer replies, I need to travel to Plovdiv to buy a specific book.
Okay, so the team digs deeper.
Right. Why the book? To prepare for an upcoming lecture. Then the team asks about the pain points of this whole process. And the customer explains that carrying heavy books is terrible, the commute wastes hours of study time, and they're on a tight deadline.
So the core problem isn't transportation at all. It's knowledge acquisition.
Precisely. And once they uncover the actual need, the solution evolves rapidly. It goes from a bus ticket to offering a courier service to deliver the book, to offering a digital copy of the book, to providing an audiobook so they can listen while doing other things.
And finally, right, the ultimate solution, providing an AI-generated summary of the audiobook.
Exactly. It's the exact same user. But because the team kept digging into the why, the outcome radically shifted from optimizing a travel route to instantly delivering the required knowledge.
I mean, it just goes to show customers consistently express wants, but discovery uncovers needs.
Right.
If you stop at the bus ticket, you burn engineering cycles, optimizing a commute for someone who honestly never actually wanted to travel in the first place. So how do you practically stop teams from building the bus ticket?
Well, Graham McNichol offered a tactical approach for this with the HAM framework. HAM stands for Hypothesis, Actions, Metrics, MVP. It's basically a structured way to force yourself to validate an idea before writing a single line of production code. You have to clearly state your hypothesis, define what user actions would prove it true, set the metrics to track those actions, and build the smallest possible MVP to test it.
What I really like about his approach is his emphasis on the painted door test.
Yes.
Like, instead of spending 2 months building a backend for a new analytics dashboard, you just put a button on the user interface that says new analytics dashboard.
It's so simple.
Right. If a user clicks it, they get a polite message saying the feature is in beta and asking if they want to join the wait list. That takes, what, one afternoon to build? If nobody clicks the button, you just saved hundreds of development hours. You learned to train your product sense.
And Baisia Kubica had some incredible advice on that exact concept of product sense. You know, people tend to treat product sense like it's this magical intuition that only Steve Jobs had.
Right, like you're just born with it.
But she breaks it down as a highly systematic loop. First, you set up an automated system to pull customer signals from every channel, support tickets, sales call transcripts, Slack channels.
Okay.
Then, the crucial step, you map those qualitative complaints directly against your quantitative usage data.
So if 10 customers tell sales that the onboarding process is confusing, you don't just take their word for it.
Exactly. You cross-check that against your analytics. If the data shows a 40% drop-off at step 3 of onboarding, you have verified the problem.
Right. And you score your confidence based on that signal count.
Yep.
If a stakeholder demands a feature, but zero customers have mentioned the pain point, and the data shows absolutely no friction, your confidence score is zero. It removes the emotion from prioritization.
And finally, once you do build a solution, her system requires linking the shipped feature back to the original customers who flagged the problem so sales can immediately close the loop.
That is just a phenomenal system for finding the right problem. But let me throw a wrench in this.
Yeah.
Let's say you run the perfect discovery loop. You use the ALM framework, you avoid the bus ticket trap, and you find the absolute perfect problem to solve. How do you actually convince the executive team to fund the build?
Ah, right. Sherdal Mehta addressed this exact friction point. He argued that product leaders simply have to learn how to speak revenue.
Speak revenue.
Yeah. We get so enamored with our own craft, right? We talk about customer obsession, seamless user journeys, and continuous discovery. But executives do not speak in features. They speak in margin, growth, retention, and cash flow.
Yeah, you have to map the product work directly to the corporate P&L scoreboard. You cannot walk into a boardroom and just say, funding this AI feature will really reduce friction in the user experience.
They'll just tune you out.
Exactly. You have to translate it. You have to say, this solution eliminates a workflow bottleneck that our data shows is responsible for a 2% churn rate. Fixing it preserves $4 million in annual recurring revenue.
Yes, because if you cannot connect the discovery to the business outcome, you will be completely locked out of the room where the actual strategic decisions are made.
Okay, so let's follow this through. You nail the discovery, you successfully speak revenue to the executives, you secure the funding, and your team builds a brilliant AI-native product.
Awesome.
Now you have to push it into the market.
Okay. Right.
And the SaaS landscape it is entering is completely warping right beneath us.
It really is a totally different battlefield now. Taylor Denk made a prediction about this that is, frankly, going to make a lot of people uncomfortable.
Oh.
He stated that within 2 years, UI and UX, the user interface and the user experience, won't even matter.
Wow. I know if you were a UI designer listening to this right now, you're probably rolling your eyes, but his underlying logic is actually very hard to dismiss.
It really is. For the last decade, SaaS companies competed by building cleaner dashboards and prettier interfaces. But Denk points out that visual software interfaces are rapidly being replaced by agentic infrastructure.
Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, he used his own team as an example. They use Linear for issue tracking, but they almost never log into the actual Linear web application anymore. They just type requests into Slack, and an AI model like Claude processes it.
Ah, the enabler here is something called the Model Context Protocol, or MCP, right?
Exactly. Which sounds incredibly dense, I know. But think of the MCP as a universal translator. It allows an AI model to securely plug directly into the API of tools like Slack, GitHub, or Salesforce.
So the AI can pull data and execute commands without ever needing to look at the visual interface designed for humans. The interface becomes completely invisible.
Yes. And if the interface becomes invisible, the entire way a software company wins market share changes.
Naturally.
Aditya Santhanam calls this the Netflix moment for SaaS. Buyers are suffering from severe subscription fatigue. They are exhausted by managing 100 different point solutions with 100 different logins.
Right.
Because of that, software is rapidly consolidating. The next era of SaaS won't be won by the company with the deepest, most niche feature set. It will be won by the platforms that command the attention, control the distribution, and own the core customer relationship.
It's like opening the best restaurant in the world.
Yeah.
You know, you have Michelin star chefs. The food is unbelievable. But your building has no front door and you aren't listed on any map.
Exactly.
If a user is just asking an AI agent in Slack to complete a task and that agent uses an API to do it, the depth of your beautifully designed standalone app doesn't save you. You have been abstracted away.
Which really highlights a harsh truth that Laura Anderson brought up. She noted that products rarely fail. It is commercialization that fails.
Oh, that's a great point.
You can have a brilliant engineering team that delivers flawlessly and product managers who prioritize physically. But if the sales team doesn't know how to lead with the new capabilities and customer success doesn't know how to position it to prevent churn, user adoption will just flatline.
And her critical insight is that AI cannot solve this for you.
Exactly. AI can write your code and synthesize your user data, but AI cannot build organizational alignment across your revenue teams. It cannot look a buyer in the eye and build market trust. Commercialization remains a distinctly human team sport.
And a massive part of winning that team sport is how you position yourself in a crowded market. Like, Christopher Godwin pointed out that when great B2B SaaS products lose deals, it is almost never because they had inferior functionality compared to the winner.
Let me guess, they lose deals because they have generic positioning.
Exactly. It's the classic, we help enterprise teams scale efficiently pitch.
Oh yeah, we've all heard that one.
Right. If your website, your pitch deck, and your sales email sound identical to the five other vendors in your category,
yeah,
the buyer's brain just tunes it out. They can't distinguish your unique value.
And here is the mechanical reality of buying behavior, right? When buyers are confused, they default to safety. They either pick the cheapest option available or they pick the legacy brand name they heard of first. It wasn't the product that killed the deal. It was the failure to distinctly position it.
Which brings us to a really fascinating endpoint. I mean, we have traced how AI is automating the logistics of product management, turning strategy into the ultimate bottleneck, and shifting the market battlefield away from visual interfaces toward commercialization and platform distribution.
Yeah, but if we take Tyler Denk's prediction to its logical conclusion that AI agents will replace traditional interfaces and handle user workflows via APIs, we are rapidly approaching a surreal threshold.
What do you mean?
We are entering a world where your software product's primary user isn't a human being at all. The user clicking the buttons, reading the data, and executing the workflow is another AI agent.
Wow. That is a staggering thought.
Right. How do you design user experiences? How do you market your value proposition? And how do you price your software when both the buyer and the day-to-day user is an algorithm?
Yeah, that is the reality the tech industry is accelerating toward. And it basically changes absolutely everything.
Something to chew on the next time you are grooming that backlog.
Definitely. If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on ICT and tech, artificial intelligence, cloud, sustainability and green ICT, defense tech, and health tech.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.